Welcome to State of the Day. I'm Ethan Elkind. This hour, the Trump administration is once again targeting state climate policies with a sweeping executive order that could change the course of California's environmental future. We'll dive into the legal and political battles ahead with experts from California's climate community. And later, we'll take a deep dive into the muscles that move us with local author Bonnie Tsui. But first, former Congresswoman Barbara Lee has been declared the winner of Oakland's special mayoral election, defeating her opponent, former Oakland Councilmember Lauren Taylor, by a narrow margin. Now, as Lee prepares to take office, attention is focused on her priorities for the city. In her plan for her first 100 days in office, the mayor-elect promises to focus on homelessness, public safety, and stimulating the city's economy, among other goals. But Lee is inheriting the same problems and budget constraints as her predecessors and may struggle like they did to make headway on Oakland's complex issues. So here to share more about Lee's plan and potentially foreshadow what may be next for Oakland under the mayor-elect's leadership is Shomik Mukherjee, a reporter from the Bay Area News Group. Shomik's coverage includes Oakland with a focus on local politics. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Shomik.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
So, Shomik, Barbara Lee is the winner of Oakland's special mayoral election. Can you tell us what were the key differences in Lee and former Oakland council member Lauren Taylor's campaigns?
Well, you know, policy-wise, they weren't that different. They sort of echoed each other's principles about incentivizing business and prioritizing public safety. To the extent there was daylight between them, in a policy sense, it really manifested in addressing the structural budget deficit that Oakland expects to face over the next 2 years. Taylor billed himself as the kind of leader who would make what he called the hard choices around spending, which really indicates additional layoffs of city workers. Lee, on the other hand, called layoffs a last resort, and she pledged to sort of wrangle more state and federal funds for Oakland while honing in on new revenue streams. But Lee supporters, including the public labor unions that spent a lot of money to help her get elected, they believe that during discussions of the city's finances, someone of Lee's political stature will command the respect of both the unions and the council members who are going to vote on her proposed budget amendments next year. Beyond that, I think Taylor billed himself as a younger mayor, as somebody who'd be a younger mayor and someone who was could bring fresh ideas to Oakland. Whereas Lee, I think, came to be seen as this kind of larger stabilizing force for a city that's been at divides politically and has had a rough few years after the pandemic, has had this vacuum in leadership after the recall of Mayor Sheng Tao last fall. And someone who her supporters saw Lee as someone who could bring people together, bring the city back on its feet.
And it was a very close vote. I believe Lee ended up with about 53%, Lauren Taylor 47%. Is there anything we can read into those final results about how voters felt between those two candidates and any type of mandate?
Well, you know, based on the percentages he gave are results of ranked choice voting, which played a huge role in the 2022 election. In this case, pending what the county estimates are a few hundred ballots left to be counted, it's looking like Lee is going to win the race outright, which is to say she would have just under 50% of first place votes to Taylor's 45%, which would give her the clear majority, meaning ranked choice vote transfers wouldn't actually be necessary to determine the outcome. Still, she faced kind of a challenge from Taylor that surprised a lot of people who felt that Lee's entry into the race would clear the field and it would be she would run away with it. And it does represent in a lot of ways that there are different ideas in Oakland about how the city should move forward.
Well, and also there's an interesting geographic divide. The Oakland Hills leaned much more heavily for Lauren Taylor, while the flatlands of Oakland supported Lee. What does that tell us about the divisions within the city?
Yeah, it's a tricky conversation. Taylor's support definitely was concentrated in the hills, which typically house higher income and often more politically moderate residents, though that's kind of a generalization. It's based on demographic data. Oakland's diverse all around. But a lot of Taylor's supporters, yeah, they seem to be clamoring for what they would describe as a more pragmatic, more numbers-driven approach to leadership. Lauren wasn't shy about his friendly relationship with the tech industry, so I imagine some voters were looking at Daniel Lurie in San Francisco and thinking, that wouldn't be so bad in Oakland. But Lee, on the other hand, won voters, indeed, in all of West Oakland and North Oakland, downtown, much of the area around Lake Merritt, all the way through East Oakland, as you say, the flatlands. Part of this is what political experts sort of always expected, that a very well-known congresswoman who served the East Bay for 26 years would have like this broad swath of name recognition and also, simply put, popularity. But it also might suggest that Oakland, you know, despite how tough the pandemic was in terms of crime and the local economy, in spite of how chaotic the fallout was from the Sheng Tao administration, this town remains quite progressive, and I've spoken to many voters who genuinely believe Lee can sort of heal some of the pain of the past few years and bring people together.
Yeah, we're speaking with Shomik Mukherjee, a reporter from the Bay Area News Group, about Mayor-elect, Oakland Mayor-elect Barbara Lee and her plans for the first 100 days. Now, Shomik, you mentioned that this election was triggered by the recall last year of former Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao. How did that context shape the mayoral race, if at all, especially concerns over public safety and corruption?
Yeah, this became, at least in the way we were covering the election, a central theme of the race, that the fallout from the Tao administration, including this ongoing federal corruption case for which he faces felony charges, that it cast a shadow over both Lee and Taylor. Taylor made clear he wanted the seat before Tao was even removed from office. And in some ways, very early on, it felt like he was still running against Tao. And indeed, supporters of both the candidates tried to tie the opposing candidate to Tao. It was almost surreal, just personally speaking, how her name alone became so politically toxic in Oakland during this election cycle. Backers of Lee accused Taylor of being the city hall insider because he served a term on the city council with Tao, although he was never an ally of hers. And he went after Lee for endorsing against Tao's recall. And the recall was passed by a huge margin, over 60% of voters. And Lee said, "Well, I oppose recalls in general." And she kind of pleaded with voters to move on from the Tao era. But, you know, I will note that at Lee's first press conference last week, Tao's name didn't come up at all in any of the questions from reporters or anything else that was said. And maybe that is a sign of how Oakland, now that the leadership vacuum is filled, actually is moving on.
Yeah. And well, we'll see if that dynamic rears itself again. But I think you're probably right that we're moving on from the recall, barring any further news. Let's talk about Oakland Mayor-elect Lee's 10-point plan for her first 100 days as mayor. How does the plan address some of the voter concerns, specifically around public safety, homelessness, and the economy, which were the big issues that she highlighted?
Yeah, the plan is fairly wide-ranging, and it's also very broad. She talks about, you know, fostering collaboration and trust with both the city's police and its business owners. Part of her promise to get more outside money for Oakland, which is a huge part of her campaign. It's another point in her plan, which it's she says she's going to secure what she calls the city's fair share of resources from Alameda County to fight homelessness. She plans to convene the CEOs of Oakland's 10 largest employers. We're talking about PG&E and Kaiser Permanente and Blue Shield and others to discuss public-private partnerships. There's talk of a forensic audit of city contracts, which touches on both the city's budget problems and also this ongoing corruption case, which involved city contracts. And crucially, Lee wants to form a committee that would examine Oakland City Charter and how it defines the mayor council structure in Oakland. And this is on the back of an essay published by a former city administrator, Steve Falk. The idea being that Oakland's mayor is essentially a cheerleader. The city council has all the final legislative power, while day-to-day operations are run by the city administrator, whom the mayor can hire and fire. So it's this kind of gray area in terms of who's actually calling the shots in the city at times. So in the coming months, Oakland may look to San Francisco, which has a stronger mayor system, or perhaps to San Jose, where the mayor is effectively just the president of the city council. Either way, it seems like Lee is very interested in changing the city's power structure, but the overall plan is pretty broad, and she hasn't taken office yet. And it's, as someone who hasn't lived in Oakland full time for a while, I think it's safe to say she would kind of need a little bit of time to kind of get specific.
And how do her goals for the first 100 days in office compare to her predecessors, like Oakland Mayor Sheng Tao and before Sheng Tao, Mayor Libby Schaff?
Well, you know, it's funny you ask that, because the Tao administration was like just such a one-off in terms of any mayor. I mean, 2023 was a really wild year for Oakland, where in the first month, the city was hit by this ransomware attack that shut down a lot of its technological systems and exposed all this sensitive data among employees. People barely even remember that now. That's the kind of thing that would be the worst thing that happens to a city like in a while. But there's so much has happened since, where crime was really bad in 2022, and bad again in 2023. It ticked down slightly last year. The A's and the deal for the A stadium in Oakland fell apart, and the A's within the time of within Tao's tenure basically said they were leaving and did leave. And there's all kinds of scandals and stuff that was just cropping up and I forgot to mention that Tao had to fire the police chief in Oakland over this kind of misconduct scandal that broke out in her first month in office. So her tenure was sort of unique, and I think in some ways, as chaotic as it was, both kind of through unforeseen challenges and maybe avoidable struggles that she had, it gave the impression that Oakland is this sort of chaotic and broken and dysfunctional place. And there are obviously things about that are undeniably true, and Lee hasn't sort of shied away from that. But I think voters who supported Lee are hopeful that her tenure would kind of mark a cooling down of kind of the craziness that Oakland's been subjected to since the pandemic.
And Shomek, the last time you were on State of the Bay, we were discussing Oakland's budget deficit. Can you talk about the latest there? What's going on now with Oakland's budget situation?
Yeah, it's facing Oakland's facing a structural budget deficit, which means that its fixed costs are outpacing its revenues, which means that the city will likely need to cut spending over the next 2 years. I think this next fiscal year, which starts in July, the city faces a $130 million shortfall. And it's going to be expected to the city leaders are going to be expected to make pretty deep spending cuts. They already laid off a few dozen employees earlier this year and have slashed funding for nonprofits. It's likely they're going to need to make even deeper cuts. And this is all sort of on the back in the context and the backdrop of this Coliseum sale. The city sold its share of the Coliseum, or is attempting to sell its share of the Coliseum to an outside group. And that was sort of this Hail Mary fix for the budget that Tao had approved. And at this point now, the deal is still in the works. It's expected to close next year, but none of the revenue from it is going to be budgeted any longer against the city's general fund, which is the fund that pays worker salaries and day-to-day operations. So some of that money is just going to have to be cut from no matter who, and that would have been the case no matter who the mayor was. At the same time, voters in the special election did approve a new sales tax measure that's expected to generate between $20 and $30 million annually. So that will apply a band-aid. And Lee, during the campaign, she like I said, called layoffs the last resort. She pledged to kind of find more revenue streams and wrangle more dollars from the federal government and from California and from Alameda County to generate more revenue for the city. But it's going to be a kind of a tough stretch for Oakland as it tries to get out from under this structural shortfall.
Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time, but I just wanted to ask you about her plan. She's going to be 80 when her term ends, which is just filling out Sheng Tao's remainder of her term. So that means that Mayor-elect Lee would be in office through 2026. Any thoughts about if she might decide to run again, or is this just sort of a placeholder for her career?
It's a great question, and it's one that she hasn't answered. She's been very coy about. If she were to run again, she would have to run for a 4-year term. As you said, this is just kind of it was going to be a stopgap to complete Sheng Tao's term either way. But we'll sort of have to see. In some ways, maybe it'll depend on how the next 17 months go. But I know that when it appeared likely that Tao was going to be removed by voters last November, like there are already these sort of progressive forces in town galvanizing around the idea of Barbara Lee stepping in and being the mayor of Oakland. And that was sort of I think her biggest backers, the city's public labor unions, didn't want there to be sort of this kind of chaos, this kind of carousel around the city's potential leaders, and wanted someone like Barbara Lee, this person with a ton of political gravity and a really strong reputation, to step in and bridge the city to the future. But as far as whether she'll run again, I think only she could probably answer that question, and she won't.
Well, we'll have to see. And if so, we definitely want you back on, if not before then. But we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Shomik Mukherjee, reporter with the Bay Area News Group. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a bunch. Good to be here.
And coming up after the break, will California be able to safeguard its climate policies from the Trump administration? Stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll hear about one woman's long, frustrating road to a new normal.
My liver had failed. My kidneys had failed. I had pulmonary edema. That's when they told everyone in my family that if she's lucky, she'll just die.
A new episode of Book It, that's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Join us for Your Legal Rights Wednesday evenings at 6. Host Jeff Hayden and guests cover a wide variety of legal topics and issues, from tax tips to landlord-tenant issues, discrimination and workers' rights on the job, as well as broader constitutional issues. That's Your Legal Rights every Wednesday evening at 6 here on 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area and online at KALW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. The Trump administration is once again targeting state-led environmental efforts with a sweeping executive order that challenges key climate initiatives, such as California's cap-and-trade program and its push for zero-emission vehicles, including electric vehicles, policies that the administration claims are hindering U.S. energy production. Now, this move has sparked strong opposition here in California, where officials are determined to defend their climate agenda. Meanwhile, Governor Newsom and state legislators have already announced plans to seek an extension of California's cap and trade program, which we'll talk about in a bit. But the future of the state's climate policies remains uncertain, with challenges not only in Congress, but also in the courts. And all of this is happening as the U.S. government rolls back federal climate regulations and cuts essential funding and personnel from federal agencies. So tonight we'll explore these challenges and their potential impact on California's climate policies. And we're very pleased to be joined by California's Secretary for the Environmental Protection, Yana Garcia. Welcome to State of the Bay, Secretary Garcia.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Blanca Begert, California climate and energy reporter at Politico and a contributor to Politico's daily California climate newsletter. Welcome, Blanca.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined, our third but definitely not least panelist, Michael Wall, chief litigation officer at Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC, a nonprofit environmental advocacy group. Thanks so much for joining us, Michael.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And State of the Bay listeners, we're going to open up the phone lines early tonight to hear from you. What concerns do you have about Trump's new executive order targeting state-level climate protections? The phone lines are open. You can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can always send us a message on Blue Sky at State of Bay or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So let's dive in. We've got an expert panel and a lot to cover. So Blanca, let me start with you. If you can just set the stage for us. What does President Trump's executive order on protecting American energy, as it's titled, what does it say exactly?
Yeah, so earlier this month, Trump signed this order. It's actually called Protecting American Energy from State Overreach. So it's basically instructing his Attorney General, Pam Bondi, to end the enforcement of state climate rules that the administration sees as impeding the development of, you know, some of Trump's favorite energy resources like oil, natural gas, coal, geothermal, and nuclear. So it targets state laws that, you know, the administration says go beyond their authority and quote unquote dictate national energy policy. And in sort of a preamble, it calls out a few specific state laws. So in New York and Vermont, it references climate superfund laws that these states passed last year to fine oil and gas companies for the damage stemming from their past emissions. And it also calls out California's cap and trade system, which is, you know, California's programs that it's had since 2012 to put a lowering cap on emissions in the state and let companies buy and trade pollution allowances up to that cap. So yeah, and it also calls out states that have sued oil companies under nuisance laws, which would include famously California and dozens of other states and local governments. So we don't know exactly what they plan to do, but for now he ordered the AG to get back to him at the beginning of June on rules that she finds to be unconstitutional or unenforceable.
So it's a whole kitchen sink there being thrown, it sounds like. Blanca, I appreciate you summarizing that. And Secretary Garcia, a couple questions for you. First of all, can you just tell listeners what California's cap and trade program is and what exactly is at stake? And just secondly, how you view this executive order and its attempt to undermine state level climate policies here in California?
Yeah, sure. And thanks again for hosting what I think is a super relevant conversation. I know I speak for a lot of folks in saying that we're getting a ton of incoming, understandably, from Californians and others, including other jurisdictions, just concerned about what the response will be, what our posture will be, how we're going to continue to move the needle to address climate risk and the real dangers that we're all facing on a day-to-day basis, given the situation that we're in. So just starting, I think, with the executive orders, I just want to be clear that there are various executive actions that have been taken, right? I think that the American Energy executive order from earlier this month is one of several executive actions. And I think we have to pause for a moment and recall that much of this administration's action, rumored action, announcements are designed to instill fear, to chill action and movement building, even forms of speech and thought in ways that present real challenges legally and make us have to take a moment to just acknowledge there are ways to be able to respond to this. And a lot of the ways in which many of these executive actions will have an impact are actually yet to be seen. Some of these executive orders and actions announced by folks like the administrator at US EPA hinge on policy changes that still have to be implemented. And so I think what we're in right now is a phase of taking stock of what is really going to happen, what that means. On March 12th, you know, Administrator Lee Zeldin, who was Trump's pick to lead the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and who I should just note, you know, we have had productive interactions with, particularly as it pertains to Los Angeles wildfire cleanup, did announce his plans to deregulate critical protections for human health and the environment across US EPA. Again, we're still waiting to see what official actions that entails. We've heard a lot of rhetoric about what that could be. And what we have heard implicates some pretty serious impacts to the air that we breathe and so to our health, first and foremost. I think claiming that protecting the climate threatens the economy, which is also an underpinning of the executive order earlier this month, the federal administration is reconsidering the endangerment finding of the Clean Air Act, which has served as the basis for so many of EPA's emission standards for vehicles, for power plants, for aircraft, and other emission sources since 2009. So with that, you know, US EPA is really attempting to reverse its requirements entirely around greenhouse gas emissions with the auspice of there being some economic driver and really ignoring the risk that inaction and certainly deregulation poses not only to our health, but to the economy. So in terms of, you know, cap and trade, our California's cap and trade policy, you know, is a nation's leading climate program, holding carbon polluters accountable by charging them for emitting more carbon pollution. And as Blanca mentioned just a moment ago, I'm really incenting reductions in greenhouse gas emissions and investments in mitigation through a declining cap over time. I think important to note that, you know, cap and trade has been a bipartisan program. It has been a program that not only has enjoyed support from California residents, but also from California businesses and industry. It takes the science of climate change and designs a program that works to keep the economy going while we're also addressing climate impacts. The funds raised across the program are also implemented through projects that help to clean the air, that protect public health, that reduce reliance on fossil fuels, programs that conserve nature and invest in transit and housing. They also deliver benefits directly back to Californians in the form of a climate credit. So what we're really talking about in terms of the threat or announced threat to a climate change program is frankly disturbing just as a narrative point. You're really undermining a state's ability to serve its people and its economy, not just for the sake of addressing climate change, but really for the sake of investing in communities. Our climate change program as of last year, our cap and trade program as of last year, has funded $28 billion in investments all across the state. The emission reductions that have been achieved through the program are equivalent to taking 80% of the state's cars off the road. So this is an incredibly effective program and something that we believe strongly should not be threatened in the way that it is.
No, I appreciate you laying out just the stakes here and the full breadth of the efforts by the federal administration to really target what California is doing. And Michael Wall, just to bring you into this discussion, Chief Litigation Officer at Natural Resources Defense Council, as you look at this executive order, other attempts to undermine California's policies, what are the legal basis here? Do you think they're likely to be relying on? As Blanca mentioned, there's going to have to be a report by the Attorney General as to what types of litigation, what next steps could be taken. How do you see this playing out? What are the legal basis and what's the pushback going to look like?
Yeah, sure. So the first thing to remember is something that Secretary Garcia said, which is that these executive orders, for the most part, don't accomplish a lot directly on their own. They're kind of like memos on fancy letterhead. What they do is signal the administration's policy for the EPA or other agencies to carry out. And this executive order asked the Attorney General to use the federal government's authorities to try to stop states like California from protecting their residents from air pollution and climate disasters. Exactly how that plays out, we do need to see, but there's a track record here. The first Trump administration brought a legal challenge against California's cap and trade program, claiming it was unconstitutional and violated various provisions of the federal constitution. And the Trump administration lost. A well-regarded federal judge in Sacramento, appointed by a Republican president, ruled for the state in a very thorough opinion. So you have to ask yourself, what is the federal government doing? It's not like they left their best arguments on the cutting room floor during that first lawsuit. They presumably brought their best arguments. They lost, and they're going to take another swing at it. And I think part of this is trying to scare people, trying to intimidate states and others, maybe trying to scare off clean energy investors. At the end of the day, though, I don't think it's going to work. The courts will enforce the law as it's written, and Congress gave California very clear authority to, you know, regulate tailpipe emission standards subject to narrow exceptions that don't really apply here. The state has long-standing authority to protect its residents from air pollution. That's something that states have been doing since the founding of our country. The Supreme Court back in 1907 recognized that Georgia could address air pollution coming from a copper smelter in Tennessee. So the law here is really well established. And I think the Trump administration is swinging for the fences.
And no doubt your organization and other environmental organizations and state attorney generals are going to be quite busy over the coming years with all this litigation. I want to let listeners know this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about how the Trump administration's policies and actions are impacting California's climate goals. We have an all-star panel. We have Blanca Begert, California climate and energy reporter at Politico. Yana Garcia, California Secretary for Environmental Protection. And you just heard from Michael Wall, Chief Litigation Officer at the Natural Resources Defense Council, or NRDC. And we'd love to hear from you. The phone lines are open. How important do you think these state-level efforts are in the fight against climate change? And what alternatives would you want to see if they're rolled back? You can join us by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-825. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Or you can find us on Blue Sky. We're at State of Bay. Blanca, let me go back to you. What are your sources? What is your reporting telling you about how Governor Newsom, other California state lawmakers, including the Attorney General as well, how are they responding to this executive order, as well as just the full suite of actions that Secretary Garcia laid out targeting California?
Yeah, so I think Secretary Garcia sort of did a great job laying out how some state leaders are thinking about some of the, you know, broader threats that Trump has made through various executive orders, and, you know, threats the EPA administrator has made. I mean, lawmakers earlier this year had a special session where they approved like a bill package that included $50 million in state funding to challenge the Trump administration with lawsuits. You know, also during the last Trump administration, there were like well over 100 lawsuits that California filed against federal policy rollbacks, and I think around half of those were for environmental rules. So there is, you know, experience here, and the Attorney General obviously has already filed, I want to say like 15 lawsuits against the Trump administration, not on climate specifically, but when it comes to the order that we started this conversation talking about, the one that targets state climate laws. There hasn't actually been an attack on cap and trade yet, but Newsom and California lawmakers, for long before, you know, this order, were kind of toying with the idea of reauthorizing the program this year past its 2030 sunset date. They wanted to do it ahead of schedule to bring some certainty to the emissions trading market, where credit prices have been dropping over the past year, and there was questions about whether it would happen this year, just because, for various reasons, it's a big discussion, has lots of moving parts. But, you know, the day after this executive order, for example, Newsom and two leaders, the two leaders of the California Assembly and Senate, announced that they will reauthorize it this year, kind of doubling down, citing the executive order. They'll do it this year to commit to continuing the cap and trade program past 2030.
So, Blanca, just real quick on that point, then, does it seem like this executive order might actually embolden California legislators to reauthorize cap and trade when it otherwise would expire in 2030?
Well, I think that I don't think they would necessarily have otherwise let it expire. But it's just that it didn't, this reauthorization bill didn't have to necessarily happen this year. You know, 2030 is still a few years away. So, I think in some cases, these threats from the Trump administration, you know, I heard Senate Majority Leader Lina Gonzalez call it the other day, kind of like it sort of creates this chess game with the Trump administration where they want to push back, but they don't want to provoke. It does seem like in the case of cap and trade, it did kind of, embolden them to kind of commit more strongly to reauthorizing the program as soon as possible.
And Secretary Garcia, how is your agency, California EPA, approaching everything that's coming your way here? What is your agency and perhaps the broader executive branch in California doing in the onslaught of attacks here from the Trump administration?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, I'll say that we're staying the course. We've been through this before, albeit a little differently. I think this second version of this federal administration has taken a much more immediately active role than they did in the first Trump administration. And that I don't mean to minimize the impact that that has had not only on our agency, but many of our sister agencies, certainly local governments, most importantly, residents, families, communities that are living with the day-to-day impact in a way that, you know, to Michael's point in terms of instilling fear, that really call into question people's, you know, very security in their day-to-day lives. So I think we are first and foremost committed to staying the course on building a California for all. That is something that has always been a benchmark of the governor's administration, something that we remain deeply committed to in terms of our commitment, our mission to continue to restore and protect the environment. We have every intention of continuing that work. And I think that that also can be said for many of the priorities that you'll see moving forward, not only through the executive branch, but also with our colleagues in the legislature. And I would just say, you know, to some of the points raised by Blanca, I know there are many opinions out there about you know, the timing or what is going on with the cap and trade program. At this point, we very much look forward to working with the legislature as we move forward in the coming months. And I think the energy that we see around cap and trade at any point is really emblematic of the importance of this program to the state, the proof points that it's already shown. We've seen while we can reduce emissions, we can actually grow the state's GDP. We are not the fourth largest economy for nothing. And I think we've seen a lot of great progress that we have no intention to lose here. And we're also seeing, you know, in terms of what's at stake, the dangerous divisive rhetoric is really at stake here. Thinking that, you know, the climate action comes at the cost at a cost to economy is just not true. And we've seen that in California and we've seen that elsewhere. And in fact, we've seen the costs associated with climate change itself is severe. Spent a lot of time down in Los Angeles earlier this year. And, you know, I think we're still reeling very much from those costs and countless costs from wildfires and storms, as well as sea level rise and the other impacts of climate change, as your listeners all know very well.
And if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about how California is responding to climate policy attacks by the Trump administration. We're very pleased to be joined by Ianna Garcia, California Secretary for Environmental Protection, Blanca Begert, California Climate and Energy Reporter at Politico, and Michael Wall, Chief Litigation Officer at Natural Resources Defense Council. And the phone lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation. As California faces these challenges in the courts and in Congress, how can local communities and individuals take action to support climate protections? We'd love to hear from you. The number 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Michael, let me turn to you with a issue that has been mentioned just briefly here, which is the idea of states of going after states being able to sue fossil fuel companies for climate-related damages. And this is potentially particularly relevant given the devastating wildfires in Los Angeles that we've already referenced a bit here. Secretary Garcia just referenced them, and climate science tells us we're fueled in part by climate change. What are the implications of that hostility from the federal government towards states trying to get reimbursement for these climate-related damages?
Let me just say that, you know, I personally felt the effects of that climate change. My parents' home, the home I grew up in, burned down in one of the wildfires in Southern California, and it is devastating. And I know that people across the state are feeling that, and the state is standing up for them. The state of California, other states, municipalities have taken two different approaches. One is to bring suits under existing state law for the damages that have been caused by, you know, the companies that have profited fabulously from selling oil, and in many cases doing so deceptively. Another approach that some states have taken, California has been considering, and Vermont and New York have done this, is to enact laws that directly hold the largest climate polluters accountable for some of the damages that they've caused. There was a study that came out of Dartmouth the other day. It was published in Nature magazine that concluded that the 100 or so largest oil and fossil fuel companies had caused more than 28, or they were associated with more than $28 trillion in damages due to increased temperatures across the world. The five companies were responsible for roughly a third of that damage. And the intuition here is pretty straightforward. If people's homes are going to burn down, or their loved ones are going to die, or their fire insurance rates are going to skyrocket, who should bear the cost of that? The people who are injured? Or should the companies that have profited from that be asked to bear part of the responsibility? So the states have brought a number of lawsuits along with municipalities and others directly against the fossil fuel companies. The fossil fuel companies, of course, have been fighting back. They don't want to pay up. So far, they haven't met with a lot of success. Most recently, they tried to get the U.S. Supreme Court to hear a case coming out of Honolulu in Hawaii. And earlier this year, the Supreme Court said no, that was premature. They couldn't raise the or bring the case to the Supreme Court at that time. So they'll keep trying. And it sounds like Trump is asking Attorney General Bondi to weigh in on the fossil fuel company's side. But let me just come back to the point here that the state's authority here is very well established. It dates back to the founding of the country. And I think the states have a great chance of succeeding.
Yeah, well, we'll certainly watch this case unfold, but I suppose for those who care about the climate, that is heartening to hear. Let me turn to the issue of vehicle emissions and California's ability to set zero emission vehicle requirements. Blanca, the Supreme Court indicated last week that's likely to hear a lawsuit from fuel producers challenging California's vehicle emission rules. Can you talk to us more about that case and what's at stake with California's zero emission vehicle program?
Yeah, so there's an effort in Congress right now to kind of overturn California's permissions from the federal government to implement like a suite of new vehicle emissions and sort of EV sales requirement rules. That's sort of separate from so that's happening, and we can talk about that. But then separately, there's an ongoing lawsuit on an older case about a California waiver for its older clean car rules. So just to explain briefly that California has special authority under the Clean Air Act to set its own tailpipe emission standards, but it needs federal permission to actually implement the rules that it sets. And under the last Trump administration in 2019, Trump tried to revoke a waiver for California's 2012 car rules that set tailpipe emission standards and required certain percentages of EV sales. That got held up in court, and then Biden reinstated it when he came into office. But oil companies and biofuel producers are suing over that waiver reinstatement, saying that the rule disadvantaged them by forcing automakers to sell cars that don't use their fuel. Last year, the DC Circuit Court of Appeals dismissed that case, basically saying they didn't have standing to sue, but the plaintiffs are bringing it to the Supreme Court. And during oral arguments that happened last week, a few of the justices did seem sympathetic to having the DC Circuit Court of Appeals take up the case again. So yeah, and yes, that's all.
Yeah, well, no, I appreciate that update, and we're just about out of time. We did get an email in from a listener, Janice. I'm going to direct this one to you, Secretary Garcia. Just very briefly, how will cuts to federal agencies and mass layoffs at these agencies affect climate action in California? So, Secretary Garcia, any quick thoughts in response to that? Do we have you, Secretary Garcia? Okay, I think we lost Secretary Garcia. So I guess I could ask you, Michael, if you wanted to weigh in on the impact of federal agencies and mass layoffs there, what that might mean for California, just very briefly.
Yeah, well, the EPA plays an important role in setting a national floor for environmental pollution and other standards that protect us. And if agencies like that are laying off their scientists and sending them home, it's going to be hard for them to do their work.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate this conversation. And I just want to thank you all for joining us. Yana Garcia, California Secretary for Environmental Protection. I think we might have lost you, but I want to thank you for joining us. And Blanca Begert, California Climate and Energy Reporter at Politico, thank you for joining us.
Thanks again, Ethan.
And Michael Wall at NRDC, thank you.
Thanks.
Oh, and I think we have Secretary Yana Garcia joining us. I just wanted to thank you, Secretary Garcia.
Thank you. I'm so sorry about that. Thanks a
No
lot.
problem. Live radio. We're just happy you could join us. And thank you so much. We'll have to have you back on. A lot more to discuss on this topic. And I was going to say coming up after the break, but I think we're going to go right into it. My co-host Grace Wan sat down with local author Bonnie Choi to discuss her new book, Exploring the Powerful Role That Muscles Play Both in Our Bodies and Our Culture. It's a fascinating conversation. And if you want to hear more, we'll be posting a longer version of it on the State of the Bay page later this week. So stay tuned for that. But here it is, Grace Wan's interview with Bonnie Choi.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. For local author Bonnie Choi, muscle is more than just biology. It's personal. Her father valued strength and movement, and when she was growing up, he would take her on late-night runs and playfully urge her to flex her arms and make me a muscle. So it's no surprise that in her latest book, On Muscle, The Stuff That Moves Us and Why It Matters, Choi explores the profound role muscle plays in our lives, not just as a physical force, but as cultural and personal ones. Blending science, history, and her own experiences, Choi examines how muscles shape our identity and understanding of strength, beauty, and ourselves. And she is back here on State of the Bay. Welcome, Bonnie Choi.
Thanks, Grace. I'm so glad to be back with you.
Well, this book is more than just about muscles. I mean, on their face, muscles seem to be about being strong and being healthy, but you posit that muscles stand for so much more.
One of the things I noticed right away when I was researching this book was how much muscle insinuates itself into our lexicon. Think about all the ways we talk about strength and muscling through things. That stands for grit or being flexible or down at the mouth. All of these, they're physical states of being that have to do with our muscles. Even when we're telling ourselves to not be people of action, we're telling ourselves to relax. And that's a muscular state of being too. And so I think the metaphor of it for our existential states as people is so wonderful.
Yeah, the book highlights some incredible feats of strength and endurance. And I'd love to talk about some of those, like people who run 50 miles through the Nevada desert or pick up these famously heavy, I'm going to not say this right, I think Scottish, is it a dinny stone?
Dinny stones, yes. The
What
Scottish
are they?
stones.
And why should we care about them?
Well, I think everyone can understand the idea of lifting a big rock to show manhood, I guess.
Yes,
I mean, it's
yeah.
very prehistoric, right? And in many cultures around the world, lifting a heavy object was a measure of strength and manhood over the centuries. And demonstrations of strength publicly were a way to show what I call leadership skills. I guess you would call it now, but it was a way to demonstrate power. And so this was so interesting to me to unearth these stories in different cultures, everywhere from like Scotland to Japan to India. And in Scotland, lifting heavy rocks was something that was done for many centuries and still today is a tradition. And in the 1970s, Jan Todd, who was a pioneer power lifter, she was the first woman to lift the Dinny stones, which were a very special set of stones of strength. And the crazy thing is that she would remain the only woman to do so for like another 40 years.
Oh,
So she was really ahead of her time and was such a trailblazer for so many of these strong women to come.
As we age, there are always some muscle parts that take the brunt. And I love that you devoted an entire chapter to shoulders. Tell me a little bit about why they are so important to us.
well, I have a bias for a really beautiful set of shoulders because I'm a swimmer. But I think going back to the whole metaphor of what muscle is, in our society and culture, like shouldering a burden or squaring your shoulders means that you're preparing to do something hard. And wearing a power suit with big shoulders in the 80s, like women were wear these crazy suits to telegraph power in the office, right? And I think there's a lot to unpack about that. And we don't have enough time to talk about all of those things, but I do make an attempt to do that in the book because I find it so fascinating how we really attribute so much more to muscle than the thing itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I recently read a New York Times article that said it's all my glutes, that if I would just fix my glutes, I'd live a better and happier life.
Well, if you think about how our glutes now are used more for sitting than for running on the prairie or the savannah, that is really sad. We got to wake them up.
Yeah. So you pick the glute as one of the muscles that you sketch. You're a beautiful artist.
Thank you.
Triple threat here. Athlete, writer, and artist. And I was curious, why was that one of the muscles that you did pick to depict?
You know, I drew a whole bunch of muscles over the course of the last several years because I wanted to trace bodily what was talking about. And because my dad was a professional artist, physically following that visual echo, I guess, because everything is movement, including art. And Paul Klee had this great quote that I put in the book about art is actually an exercise in movement because you're capturing a dancer who's moving and your eyes following this dancer and your hand is roving around trying to capture it. You think about visual art as static, but it's not. It is all about movement. Even the appreciating of the finished product is. And even handwriting, when we're listening to a lecture, it's different when we're writing things down with our hands than typing because we are processing from a different part of our brain and has to do with movement. And so drawing was important for all those reasons. And the opening of the book is Make Me a Muscle. And I drew that quintessential like Popeye arm pose. But in the end of the book, it made sense eventually to draw the glute because it's the butt end. And in the endurance section of the book, which is the last section of the book, there's a lot about how the gluteus maximus really is something that is fundamentally human and aided in our evolution. And despite the fact that we're sitting on them more than ever these days, no other animal on Earth has such a large gluteal muscle. And it really contributed to our success on this planet.
You know, this is not an exercise book. It really is about the study of muscles. And you quoted a Stanford psychologist, Kelly McGonigal. Mm. And she wrote that we have a pharmacy in our muscles. And I wanted you to unpack that for our listeners.
So one of the things I found out that I did not know before was that muscle is an endocrine tissue, which means it's not just the stuff that is moving our skeleton around, but when the muscles move, they are sending molecular messengers all around our body. So it's this wash of chemicals. You know, if you and I were to get up after our conversation and take a walk, from the first couple of minutes, our muscles are talking to all these parts of our bodies, including our brains. And so they're regulating all kinds of physiological and metabolic processes throughout our body. And they are actually making our brains bigger and stronger. Like in the hippocampus, exercise is known to stimulate growth, formation of new neurons, and synaptic plasticity in places where there's learning and memory. So bulking up our muscles bulks up our brain. And it's mood regulation too. Our muscles are constantly doing things when we're moving to regulate cognition and mood and our emotional states. So when we get that endocannabinoid dopamine rush and we feel so good when we're moving, it's because these are all self-reinforcing activities that are so beneficial for our health. And researchers are now very vocal about how maintaining muscle mass and working on strength training as you get older is so important for our cognitive function, our brain, maintaining our neurological function as we age.
Well, this book is as much about muscles as it is about your father. And when you were young, your father took you and your brother, gave you the same exercises, and it was about showing strength and endurance. Those early messages that you could be physically powerful, did those have long-lasting impacts?
Oh, for sure. I think that while I'm very aware of this cultural landscape that we exist in, I was largely inoculated to a lot of it because of my upbringing and because of my early life in sports. I remember going to pool parties in middle school and all of my female friends would be wearing big t-shirts. And it wasn't because they were afraid of getting tan. They just didn't want to show their bodies. And I just thought, this is so interesting because I was used to my body not being something to be looked at, that it worked. The reason I was wearing a swimsuit was so I could swim and I could swim fast. That's why I think sports for kids of all ages and genders is so important, because you learn that your body works for a reason, right? That there's a certain function. You're running around, you're swimming or you're rowing or you're dancing or whatever. And obviously there are all kinds of cultural norms about what your body should look like. Like, if this is pervasive, but at least on some level, you are aware that your body works.
Well, your father had a muscle academy with you and your brother, and you have started a muscle academy with your son. What are you guys doing together?
I will tell you, when I started working on this book, we had a lot of pandemic PE in the house. So we would do schoolwork. And then when people started getting crazy, we would do burpees and run around the block. And the burpees have stuck around. I'm proud to say that my children do a pretty mean burpee.
I'm impressed. I'm a little scared to go to your house.
Make everyone who comes over do a burpee, but you can if you want.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Bonnie's new book is On Muscle, The Stuff That Moves Us and Why It Matters. It's available in bookstores now. Such a pleasure to speak with you.
Always a joy. Grace, thank you.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners. Next Monday at 6, we'll explore the nation's first undergraduate program in psychedelics to be offered right here in San Francisco. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Chris Nooney. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator.